Dr. Paul with Temple of Health Radio Show, and today we're pleased to have Dr. Edward Close and his book, Nature's Mold Treatment, The Non-Toxic Solution to Toxic Mold. And this certainly comes at an important time for Atlanta because we had floods in October, I believe, and many of us are dealing with toxic mold. Welcome, Edward. How are you doing?
Well, thank you. I'm very, very good, very well, and pleased to see you this morning.
Great. Well, we had our clinic treats a lot of mold problems. We treat sick building syndrome from buildings.
Mm-hmm.
We treat sick building syndrome from mold in and around breast implants, which is actually you carry the building around with yourself. And we treat Morgellons disease, which is often preceded with toxic mold, especially if the entire family has it. There's usually an underlying immune deficiency. So I've seen many families that travel from all over the world to come to our clinic with these problems. I'm real pleased that you have a less toxic and less expensive solution for sick buildings. I think that's very important. Would you like to talk a little bit about what percentage of buildings and houses, office buildings, houses have mold, and how this is a problem in environments that are not extremely dry, like maybe Las Vegas?
Yes. interestingly enough, we're finding that even in dry climates, there are mold problems because people rely on air conditioning and central air and heat, and
right.
Mold often gets into that system without the owners even knowing it, and it's a big problem. Studies show that 50% or more of homes that have been studied have mold problems, and that there's a much higher incidence of respiratory problems and other things in homes or among people who live in homes that have mold, and it's undiagnosed, which is it's just not recognized many times that mold exposure is the basis, maybe not always the cause, but we can get into that more as we go, but if you'd like, but mold exposure quite often is linked to a great number of diseases. And in the past, many people said, well, that can't be. Mold can't be causing these. Well, the problem is mold and other microbes, bacteria and viruses, work in conjunction
right.
with each other. They enhance each other, and many times mold exposure is at the base of health problems. And mold infestation has a lot of economic ramifications too, and property and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, there is mold exposure as well, just in the general air. I mean, not even when you're in buildings. If moisture
right.
has been on the ground for a long time. I have a lot of patients with fibromyalgia, and I notice that they all flare at once when the weather's been damp. So
absolutely.
There's
yeah,
a generalized exposure.
Aspergillus is, or aspergillus, depending on how you like to pronounce the G, is common. It's ubiquitous in the environment, especially anywhere east of the Mississippi River. Even the whole Mississippi Valley from there on east, but it's true everywhere. You find it everywhere. It's a problem in hospitals. It's a problem in office buildings. One of the problems is caused by back in the 70s, there was a proclivity to build office buildings and hospitals and such with flat roofs with the air handling systems
mm-hmm.
on the top. Those buildings invariably leak, and mold gets into the system and causes havoc.
Mm-hmm. Now, not all mold is toxic, and that brings us to the question of testing your environment. You can have mold that is relatively non-toxic because it doesn't produce the biotoxins and these aromatic things, which I wasn't familiar with. You want to explain the difference between the mycotoxin or the actual toxin produced and the aromatic things that we smell?
Yes, they're two different things. They're not totally mutually exclusive, but they are different types of things. The volatile compounds that are produced by mold account for the musty odor, the smells, and that sort of thing. The toxins are not necessarily VOCs, and they're the ones that cause almost immediate damage if they get into the respiratory system, the bloodstream, or the nervous system of people. But about 25% of the people on the planet have a sensitivity to even molds that normally don't produce toxins, allergenic reactions, or respiratory or rash, skin rash, that sort of thing.
Right.
But the toxins, not all mold is toxic for sure, and not all black mold is toxic, and not all toxic mold is black.
Right. There you go.
So,
that's true. I had a patient with a penicillamine in her breast, inside her saline breast implant, and she was allergic to penicillin. Can you imagine what that was doing? you can't get away from it.
Yeah, people don't realize that there are some strains, some species, subspecies of penicillium that are almost as bad as the ones that have gotten a bad name, like Stachybotrys and Cladosporum. In some cases, penicillium's the root problem. And I'm told by doctors that aspergillosis is probably next to MRSA, one of the most problematic things in hospitals. In fact, I've done done testing in hospitals to solve problems, find out where the source was, and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I've interviewed Dr. Richie Shoemaker in his book, Mold Warriors, and of course he had a lot of the really good evidence that certain HLA types make one more susceptible to biotoxins.
Right.
And we've done HLA typing in the past, but it's really not necessary now because when they come in with a certain cluster of symptoms, you know they're going to have that HLA type. But essentially, the biotoxins go in and disrupt the leptin receptors in the hypothalamus and then create a huge arena of problems involving the immune, neurological, and endocrine systems, basically taking out the endocrine system at the level of the hypothalamus. So as physicians, we spend a lot of time trying to fix all of the 30 different problems that the biotoxin's causing. The biggest problem, though, I will tell you, is getting the environment cleaned up because these people often don't have a lot of money. They haven't been working. They're often in apartments where they have less control over their environment, and they're going back to a moldy environment. And that's my biggest problem. I can give them antifungals, both natural and regular antifungals, and do surgery to clean up the infected breast implants, but if they go back to a moldy house, that's a problem.
That's right, yeah, and it's just going to start up again. That's the great thing about what we found, and if you're interested, I can tell you briefly, how we discovered it. But it's both, it can take care of the problem, and it's a wonderful preventative that's reasonably expensive, reasonably inexpensive.
Inexpensive, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm an environmental engineer, PhD in environmental engineering, and the way that this happened was, and I tell the story in the book, Nature's Mold RX, and what happened was I had an engineering client who had a mold problem. He had purchased a 48-unit apartment complex, and he had tried everything. This was about a 30-year-old apartment complex that had had some flooding and leaking back when we had some flooding on the Mississippi. It was in that area close to the Mississippi River. in southeast Missouri. And he had tried everything. He had he had a construction crew remove all of the obviously damaged, water damaged and moldy materials, which in some cases, some of the apartments were practically gutted, just studs and ceiling and floor left. And he had then gone through with, they had tried everything. He had a professional cleaning crew go through, and they had used a hospital disinfectant, it turned mm-hmm. out, and that was primarily bactericides and really right. didn't take care of the fungi. Mm-hmm. And I came on the scene as an engineer to take air samples and determine for them when the apartments were free of mold problems, so that they were being developed for low-income housing, and under federal regulations, they had to pass certain standards for mm-hmm. mold and asbestos and lead paint and radon. So that was my job, and this mold problem they just couldn't solve. They had tried everything. Cleaning crew and so forth, and talking with my wife about it. My wife's a registered aromatherapist and co-author of the book, incidentally.
Oh, that's good.
And
Jacqueline.
Yeah. She, yeah. Our avocations, our work sort of came together. Our interests came together.
Right.
But she recommended. She said, "Well, why don't you try essential oils, because there are some university studies and so forth that show that pure essential oils of certain types are very strongly, effectively antifungal, antibacterial, and antiviral." And, you know, my first response was, if I go to an engineering client and tell them I'm going to solve their problem with aromatherapy, they're going to laugh me out of the room.
Unless it works.
Exactly.
Which is what you wrote the book showing.
Yep. That's
scientific
exactly
evidence.
Right.
That's right.
And the first case study in there is actually the first two or three, I think, are apartments in that complex showing the effectiveness.
Right.
And, of course, that only raised further problems. And being a scientist, I had to follow up.
Right.
Because, you know, one question was, well, they'd already used all this stuff. They'd used petrochemicals and bleach and everything.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know they hadn't practically solved the problem and you just sort of came along and polished it off?
You have to do sampling.
Right. So I had then, in the book, there are several case studies where there was no prior treatment of any kind, and it was just as effective. So that was, and one of the things that came out of the studies that was surprising, pleasantly surprising, was the residual effect. With everything else that's used out there, pretty much, you don't want the stuff to hang around because you're using hazardous chemicals to start with.
Yeah.
But with this, there's a residual effect that we've found in some cases up to 4 or 5 months after mm-hmm. the treatment. And that was just like, you know, frosting on the cake, and something that didn't think about when we went into the studies.
And it's probably because these oils are not water-soluble, so cleaning doesn't, you know, necessarily... and they penetrate things, so cleaning and the usual things don't necessarily take them back out like they would with bleach or, you know, other chemicals.
That's right. Yeah, they're very small molecules, and they
mm-hmm.
penetrate and do their job. And the blend that turned out, we tried three different, two blends and one just an individual oil.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that seemed to work the best is one that 99.something% of people that have tried it have no problem at all with the mm-hmm. with the aroma or the smell, and that's plus two. And not only it does the job, it's pleasant smelling. And we diffuse it in our home. We've got like five diffusers running, and we put them on timers.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in a 40-year-old home now. And homes develop excess moisture problems and mold. And many times, as I mentioned before, it gets into air conditioning systems, and people
right.
are not even aware of it. There's no visible sign and usually no real odor. And the first indications are health problems.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about the health problems, because I think a lot of the mystery diseases out there can be traced back to either direct mold effects, respiratory, sinus, lung, eye irritation, that kind of thing, or
mm-hmm.
the secondary effects, which are as a result of lowering the immune system, which may be where the cancer comes in and the other associated diseases. From the medical standpoint, whenever somebody comes in with fibromyalgia-type symptoms, we look at biotoxicity from mold primarily, although there are other potential biotoxins,
right.
and then chemical toxicity.
Because right.
chemical toxicity can also produce fibromyalgia. And usually it's often in the silicone implant patients, a combination of both. They get the chemical mm-hmm. toxicity from the chemicals that are leaching out of the implants, and then they get the biotoxicity from the mold and the yeast overgrowth in their body.
Yeah, worst of two worlds.
Right. And one of my environmental toxicologist buddies here called me up, and she said her sickest patients are her silicone patients, which is interesting. So all these industrial exposures to chemicals don't match anything compared to what the medical field put in women's chest walls. It's interesting.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is your body and your home are the dangerous places from a standpoint of air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Much more misery and disease comes from inside than from industrial pollution. Although I don't minimize that impact on water and air
right.
out of doors, but nature has a way of dealing with these things. It's just amazing that how resilient nature is, and that's why we're kind of excited about getting into natural solutions for things. And one of the things mentioning the linkage between mold exposure and various kinds of illnesses. My background is physics and mathematics. My undergraduate and master's level work was in the field of physics,
mm-hmm.
and I tend to look at things often because, contrary to what people think, physics is the simplest science because
yeah.
it deals with what you can weigh and measure.
Mm-hmm.
Environmental engineering is much more complex than nuclear
mm-hmm.
physics, for example, and people wouldn't think that, but it is because there are so many variables in
right.
environmental science. But I always tend to start by looking at the physical aspects of everything, and what I found was mold spores range from about 3 microns up to about 10 or 12 microns in size.
Mm-hmm.
And bacteria and viruses are generally smaller than this, and especially viruses. And mold spores stay suspended in the air much longer than bacteria or virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you've got mold exposure and you've got bacteria and viruses, which we always have in the environment, they piggyback on the mold spores.
Yeah.
And so if you get mold exposure, quite often you're getting exposure to viruses and bacteria at the same time. So this is kind of a simple answer to why there's a linkage between so many diseases. and mold exposure, you know, mm-hmm. not to mention the fact that mold exposure reduces impacts your immune system and makes you
right.
more susceptible to the other things. So they all work sort of synergistically to get at us. The job of microbes in our environment is to dispose of dead and dying organic material,
mm-hmm.
plant and animal. And the reason the essential oils work so well is they are, in one of their functions, is they're the immune systems of plants. Plants came onto the scene, according to the geologic record of fossils, about the same time that mold did.
Mm-hmm.
And mold's primary substrate that they love for food is cellulose. And
mm-hmm.
plants are primarily made up of cellulose,
mm-hmm.
as most a lot of our building materials are. So if the plants hadn't developed a way to deal with mold, they never would have survived.
Right.
And we're beneficiaries of the what plants did to survive. They will help us to survive too, because the microbes don't make a determination between living and dead. They attack you before you're in your coffin.
There you go. There's also, I want to also mention biofilms, because around implants that we put in the body, in sinuses, even probably in your gut, there's biofilms, which are layers of all these different organisms and sometimes even other parasites that have kind of a community that then becomes very resistant to traditional treatments and shares information back and forth about resistances and that type of thing. Whereas essential oils and silver as well both share the common property of not that these microbes don't develop resistance to. And
that's
so,
an excellent point, because the oils, many of them, people don't realize, you look at an oil and it looks like water. It's clear. Most of
right.
them are clear. But I tell people, well, look at gasoline or something like that. You think that that's, and water's very simple, H2O.
Mm-hmm.
But these compounds are organic compounds, and some essential oils can have as many as 150 or 160 or more
mm-hmm.
Individual compounds, organic compounds, in them. And they all kind of work synergistically, whereas allopathic medicine takes
one thing,
isolates compounds that are considered to be the effective ones, and
mm-hmm.
and produce them then synthetically in the laboratory. And the problem is the microbes are smart. They see this coming, and
mm-hmm.
it's always the same, because it's patented and it's it has to meet the standards, and it's almost always identical, same few compounds,
right.
and doesn't take them long to learn how to deal with that. Whereas with the essential oils, they change from season to season, from field where the herbs were grown, and
mm-hmm.
All sorts of things, when time of harvest and so forth. So one batch, it's like wine. One batch is going to be
right.
different than the next. And the microbes can't as easily
mm-hmm.
figure out a way to combat those. So we go back to the natural things that were provided for us. I think in this age, when people are beginning to realize that body, mind, and spirit is all, you know, are all interacting.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote an article for an international journal that was just published about less than a month ago, where I talked about the ancient remedies and things that were in some ways more effective than modern remedies. You know, when, for instance, when the Magi brought the frankincense and myrrh and gold to the Christ child, frankincense and myrrh were actually very good antibiotics that were used by especially the royalty in Egypt and in the Middle East at that time. It was common knowledge that these things are used for childbirth, frankincense and myrrh. And that's sort of lost because, of course, the Bible is a spiritual document, not a medical one.
Right. Well, that's very true, and that both frankincense and myrrh can be obtained in the essential oil form and used today if you are familiar with how to use them.
That's correct.
And they're very effective.
That's my wife's field. She's been involved in that for, about 12 years or more now, and knows a lot about using the essential oils for various problems. She's had people come to her with fibromyalgia and many of the common maladies, and by using essential oils and putting them on food supplements and cleaning up, in some cases, having me go and test their house and clean up the environment and suggest, you know, what they need to do. We've had people go from basket cases to back to very healthy and happy. So, it works.
Well, we wanted to make a point, too, that once you've had a toxic mold exposure, these mold spores get in everything, your belongings, your clothing, everything. And in the past, people just left everything behind. But I think with these diffusers and the technology you've come up with, people might be able to not have to throw everything out, which would be really good.
That's an excellent point. We have a case locally here that an elderly lady, 92 years old, went in for, I think, a knee replacement or something like that. Mm-hmm. And while she was recovering, her daughter and son-in-law went in to take care of her house and clean it up, and they found that there was mold growing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so concerned that she was beginning to show Alzheimer's-like symptoms, and there's another whole subject. I have a pretty strong belief based on not lengthy studies, but on just my observations that there could be a link between mold exposure and Alzheimer's.
Oh, well, definitely a link between mold exposure and mental clouding and being unable to communicate. There's no question.
Which is one of the things that leads them to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's.
It's probably misdiagnosed, but prion disease is another big one. You know, they don't want to recognize that our meat supply may have prions in it. So that's why Europe doesn't accept our meat. Alzheimer's is just like swine flu now. I mean, we don't test anything, we just label it. And so there's not a lot of scientific information about how many of the respiratory illnesses out there are swine flu and how many of the Alzheimer's cases are truly Alzheimer's, which is a pretty specific pathological diagnosis that can only be made after you die, I believe.
They really look at the brain.
I don't know if they do brain biopsies for Alzheimer's or not, but in any case, it's diagnosed all the time on clinical things that absolutely toxic mold can mimic.
Yeah.
So mold in nursing homes becomes an interesting
absolutely
idea.
Yeah, that's, I've done tests, and that was one of the cases where I went into the Alzheimer's ward in a nursing home and took air samples and found that in their apartments they had window air conditioners. They were actually mounted under the window, beneath the window. and that meant they were about 4 inches off the floor, right on top of the baseboard. And in every one of them, I found Stachybotrys growing behind the baseboard. So here you are taking people who've been diagnosed with Alzheimer's and putting them in an environment that's only going to make matters worse.
Right, that's true. Well, let's talk a little bit about what the essential oil blend is that you tested. I know you tested a number of them, but one of them was was used in most of the testing. That was the Thieves blend. And do you want to tell the listeners a little bit about what's in Thieves and how you get it, how you order it?
Sure. It's a blend of five oils, and they're all oils that are pleasant for the most part. As you know, essential oils, some of them are quote, hot, and some of them are not, meaning they can cause skin irritation or that sort of thing if you come in contact with too much of them. But the oils that are in the Thieves blend are lemon oil, rosemary, eucalyptus, and the oils that are in, cinnamon is in there, and it's a fairly hot oil, and clove. Those are the five oils. And they are individually effective. Clove is fairly effective, but so is rosemary. And but as a blend, they seem to work very well. We've used some other oils that are very effective, too, but often they have like oregano, but oregano is a very hot oil, and
doesn't smell good either.
Doesn't smell good. That's right.
Right.
And let's see. There's another one or two, but there's several that are effective. But it just turned out that this one worked very well, and it was.
It's also a combination, which is good. Like you said, the combinations are a little more likely to confuse the microbes or be more effective for more microbes.
That's right. As you see in the book, it appeared to be effective against across the board against almost all. There were a few cases that indicated to me that there was there were a couple of species that were more resistant to the Thieves, and in cases like that, where I saw that in the air samples or in the tape lip samples or swab samples, I added, in those cases, I will add another oil that I found to be effective for those species. But we have, on our website, we have all of these things available.
Would you give your website?
Sure. It's www.moldrx.com. And that's the number 4 and the letter U.com.
Okay, all right.
MoldRx4U.com. And we've got the oils and the diffusers and protective gear, which is one of the things people tend to overlook to their peril, and that is in the old days, people would go in and put bleach on black mold when they saw it, and in most cases they didn't use... They didn't have a respirator on or even a dust mask, you know. And you're just exposing yourself to things that can cause problems when you do that. Another myth, and we've been battling this in some of the areas where they've had flooding, FEMA comes in and they tell people, they go in and do a check with their homes if they've been flooded and the people have been evacuated. They go in and do a check trickle counter, and they say, well, it's below outside levels, so you can go back in. They don't know what molds they have growing in there, whether they're, you know, toxic
or not. Right.
And then they tell them, if you see some mold, you can clean it up with bleach and soapy water. Well, that's bad advice, because where in studies that I've done, bleach does very little for mold. It'll temporarily make a dent in it,
mm-hmm.
but bleach is about 3 to 4% sodium hypochlorite,
mm-hmm.
and the rest of it's water.
Right.
So when the sodium hypochlorite evaporates, and you don't want it hanging around long, because if it gets mixed with an acid of any kind, even vinegar or
mm-hmm.
a toilet bowl cleaner or something,
right.
you create chlorine gas.
Right, which is not good.
And occasionally people die from in their bathrooms from cleaning with bleach.
Yeah, mixing bleach and ammonia is the common one.
Yes, and so that's a problem, and the problem is that the sodium hypochlorite evaporates and you still have water there, and so if you
mm-hmm.
have a porous surface, you've just got set up. The mold usually rebounds within 24 hours of the time
mm-hmm.
you treat it with bleach.
Right. That's true. So the there's two different kinds of thieves. One is the real concentrated oil in the small bottle, and the other is the household cleanser. Is there a difference between the two?
Oh, yes. The household cleaner has a very lower concentration, lower level proportionally of the oils in it. And sometimes when we use it, if we have a very, a bad infestation, we'll add a bottle of thieves to the the oil to the household cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
What we found is effective, and I've used this in office buildings and hospitals and homes, is to do the diffusing first, and then
mm-hmm.
the diffusing won't make, if you've got black mold growing on the wall, diffusing will kill it, but
mm-hmm.
it won't make it go disappear. The blackness
right.
will still be there. A lot of times it'll kind of run and look
mm-hmm.
like it's turned into ink or something
mm-hmm.
After diffusing, but you still have to clean it up. So we recommend using the Thieves household cleaner, either full strength, although it's effective, you dilute it some,
mm-hmm.
and clean up the surface. And then one of the office buildings that I've done, they were very pleased. They thought they were going to have to remove all the drywall in
mm-hmm.
in five offices, and we put the diffusers into their air handling systems and diffused over a long weekend, and then
mm-hmm.
went in and cleaned with the household cleaner, and they didn't have to remove more than half what they thought they would have to remove.
That's good.
And so it saved them money.
Yeah. Well, the diffusers you recommend are also cold diffusers, is that right?
That's right. That way you can leave them run for 24 hours, which is what we suggest as a minimum for
mm-hmm.
like a shock treatment. It's like doing a shock treatment for a pool.
Mm-hmm.
And one diffuser of the type that we have will cover roughly a 1,000 square feet. Actually, it'll probably do a little better in a normal house, but we say
mm-hmm.
1,000 square feet to allow for different heights of ceilings and that sort of
right.
thing. And that will, our tests show that will take care of that space. And then, of course, excess moisture is a basic problem for mold. And in some cases, you can find that source and take care of it. If
mm-hmm.
it's a leaky basement wall or a crack
pipe.
Around a window or pipes, pipe leaks, new roof on the house, whatever.
Roof leaks, yeah.
Yeah, can be remedied. But in
mm-hmm.
older homes, especially older homes with basements,
mm-hmm.
It often is almost impossible to get rid of all excess moisture. So
mm-hmm.
we recommend using dehumidifiers, especially
right.
during the summer months.
Yeah.
And then putting diffusers on timers and running them.
Mm-hmm.
We put them on timers and run them like 15 minutes every 4 hours. and a bottle, a 15-milliliter bottle of oil with the size pump that we use will last about a month.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good, fairly inexpensive preventative.
Right. And you don't recommend having people in the house or pets in the house when you're diffusing, or
we don't.
Does it matter?
It generally doesn't matter, to be honest
mm-hmm.
with you. But because there's a variety of sensitivities, we found one lady who is actually very sensitive to cinnamon oil.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the blend. So
mm-hmm.
Occasionally you'll find someone who can't stay in the house during that 24 hours. So in order to cover all cases, we recommend that you not be in there during the intensive diffusing. And we had one case where an elderly dog had some problems being in the house during the
mm-hmm.
diffusing, but recovered from it very quickly. But for the average person, and so, you know, what you really need to do is just check it out for yourself and use some common sense, and if it bothers you,
yeah.
stay away. And in office, for it, that's what we do. We recommend that they do intensive diffusing on weekends or when there are fewer people or no
right.
people in the office.
I have a little machine called an AeroMist here, and you put the essential oil on the wick and then turn it on, and a mist comes up with the oil on it, and you can inhale it. I've been doing that with thieves because I've got a sinus infection.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little aromatherapy treatment that is fairly inexpensive.
Right. Yeah,
the other thing you can do is put tea tree oil in a neti pot, you know, a little bit of tea tree oil. You don't want to put too much.
Mm-hmm.
And then rinse your sinuses with that. So these are just some ideas that, you know, that work pretty well for people with chronic sinus infections.
Yeah, and most chronic sinus infections are fungal infections.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And I developed this when my crawl space flooded, and I
mm-hmm.
never had it before in my life, so there you go.
Yeah, yeah, that's the way it,
and,
the way it happens.
And I'm going to, you know, go ahead and do the diffusion. We had the crawl space treated with chemicals, you know, the
right.
construction people came in and they didn't have to tear anything out. It was it's a concrete floor,
mm-hmm.
you know, but they had to treat everything. But like you said, I'm going to have them go down there and look again, because probably now the mold's growing again because the chemicals are not effective except for maybe, 30 days, and then they can come back. So.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So that's the problem.
And that is a problem.
So I may be able to report to you later if the thieves. We use the thieves cleaning solution in the office,
mm-hmm.
and so we have that, and I've used thieves for years, you know, the essential oil.
Yeah.
Funny story about thieves, you probably have heard it, that it was called thieves because the thieves, back when the bubonic plague was prevalent, used to douse themselves with these essential oils and then go in and rob the people who had died of the plague.
Yeah.
And then they got caught by the king, and the king, under threat of death, made them give up their secrets.
Yeah.
So that's why it's called thieves.
Yeah, it was called, I think in England it was called thieves vinegar or something like that.
Right, right.
Used vinegar as a base and put oils and spices in it. And the thieves that we use, I guess, has eucalyptus, which wasn't in the original, but based on some clinical testing and so forth, the percentages of the oils were determined, and it turns out to be pretty effective. We haven't had, I used to have the flu every year,
mm-hmm.
and running an environmental consulting firm where I had 10-15 people working for me, and always had some student interns from the local university.
Uh-huh.
And of course, they had to finish their semester regardless, and they had to get credit. And then in most cases, we were paying them, and they needed the money too. So mm-hmm. they would come in all sorts of states of flu and
viruses, you know, in general, yeah,
all sorts of things. And we diffused the oils in our offices, and we've never had, in 10 years, I've had the flu once or twice now.
Yeah.
So
that would be good for these hemorrhagic flus going around now, and these nasty 80% mortality flus like bird flu.
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
Well, viruses stay on surfaces for, 3 to 4 days, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And although you can... And our office does. I mean, they wipe down everything with disinfectants, obviously.
Sure.
But still, this would be more effective because it actually diffuses into the air, so it
right.
gets everything.
Well, we had
more effective
than
just surface cleaning.
Right. But surface cleaning made me think. There are several things we've done since the book was published, quite a few more case studies, and... you know, it's kind of hard because we've got a lot of things going on, but to try to keep up with the data. And one of the things was we had a fellow in Florida, in Bradenton, Florida,
mm-hmm.
who is kind of interesting. He has a mold-sniffing dog.
Really?
Uh-huh. The dog can identify mold and where it is as well or better than sampling and analysis.
That makes sense.
Yeah, because
yeah.
their sense of smell is so acute.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to try one of the things that he does as a service is to test restaurants and sandwich shops and coffee
mm-hmm.
shops for bacteria on their surfaces. And he uses a meter that shows, I've forgotten the actual compounds that it picks up that fluoresce and that show organic activity,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's used in that industry to determine the levels of bacteria
mm-hmm.
activity that are acceptable or unacceptable in eating places. And he used the household cleaner on surfaces and found that it was more effective than what they normally use and had the residual effect, longer
right, that's,
residual effect.
That's really good. And is it toxic if eaten, you know?
Exactly.
You can actually put thieves a drop or two in water and drink it, so it's not, you know,
yeah.
it's not toxic, except in large doses. You have the material data safety sheets of these things at the back of your book and the appendix,
mm-hmm.
and you have to eat a lot of these essential oils to kill yourself more than you possibly could.
Yeah, that's one of the things we have, as you can imagine, since the book came out. We've had
mm-hmm.
Sometimes 15 or 20 calls a day, or I think one
mm-hmm.
day my wife said she had nearly 100 calls from people with questions, and
mm-hmm.
most of them are answered in the book, and there's a good index in the back,
mm-hmm.
and there's a 10-step protocol in there for
you. Yeah, I like your protocol. That's good.
Mm-hmm. And we're trying to develop, and of course there are some insurance problems and things like that, but we may be putting on our website a consulting function where if people will give me the specifics that I need to diagnose and
mm-hmm.
Determine what's going on in their house, I can give them a site-specific protocol to
mm-hmm.
use to take care of the problem. We don't have that available yet, but it's something we're working on.
Well, that would be helpful in terms of cost, because a lot of the companies that come in and do the analysis cost a great deal to do that.
Yeah, it's typically going to a house to do a proper inspection and sampling of an average house. It's going to be $300 to $500, maybe $600.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the nature of the beast with the lab expenses and the different situations you find in a home. And you've got to take outdoor samples to get a baseline
right.
background to determine. Because, as you said, there are, especially in humid climates, there are always mold spores outside.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain species that grow inside that don't show up in the outdoor.
Right.
And if you have them showing up, you know you've got them growing somewhere in the house. And then there's concentrations. If you've got 100 times or even 20 times or 10 times the level that's in the outside air, then you know you've got it growing inside too.
True. So this is something that anybody with a chronic health condition, especially fibromyalgia type or respiratory type, might consider doing doing an analysis of their office and home environments, and then according to your protocol, treating the areas and then retesting to see
yes,
if it was effective.
That's why the testing is important, in my opinion, because. Mm-hmm. I have a little saying that I use when people say, well, you know, we just can't afford to do the testing.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like going to a doctor and saying, I hurt all over, and the doctor says, well, we won't do any tests, we'll just remove everything that hurts.
Yeah, right.
You would seek another doctor.
Well,
this is exactly what remediators mm-hmm. for the most part, in this country, do. I've gone to meetings of the Indoor Air Quality Association,
mm-hmm.
and you have a lot of people that attend these that do mold remediation. And most of them don't want to do the testing, and they'll say it's because it's unnecessary added expense.
Right.
But in fact, most of them know that if you do post-treatment testing,
mm-hmm.
Unless you do it very quickly after you've done the treatment with toxic chemicals,
mm-hmm.
you'll see a rebound. And,
so they just don't want to do that at all, yeah. They don't want to go into testing. Yeah, that's true.
And
yeah, well.
when people say, well, you know, it's the oils are so expensive, I say, well, how much are you spending on doctor bills?
Exactly, or not being able to work because of those weeks you lose
with
illness. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's true. Well, we're coming up to the end of our hour. We've been interviewing Dr. Edward Close and on his book, Nature's Mold Treatment, The Non-Toxic Solution to Toxic Mold. It was co-authored with his wife, Jacqueline, who's an aromatherapist, which is why he got such good information about the oils. And their website is www.it's mold treatment for you or mold RX and then for you, is that right?
Yes, mold RX like you see on a pharmacy.
Yeah.
And then the number 4 and the letter U.
And that's .com.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got all the information up there and soon to have possibly some help with diagnosis of the problem. Up on their website. And do you have the, is it a CD available? Is that available now? Or
There's a DVD.
A DVD.
Available.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's up on your website too?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, great.
I did a couple of seminars on these problems and on the using the oils, and we put them together on this CD.
Super. Right. Well, Dr. Close and his wife have come up with a really excellent way to get your house back or your office back and your health, as well as your health back. And I highly recommend that the patients with these problems get the book and look at his website and do what is on the protocols. Next week, we're going to be interviewing Dr. John Turner. He's a neurosurgeon, Medicine, Miracles, and Manifestations. A Doctor's Journey Through the Worlds of Divine Intervention, Near Death Experiences in Universal Energy. And then on the 26th, we're interviewing Dr. William Norquist on The Stealth Killer is Oral Spiro ketosis, the missing link in dental and heart disease labyrinth. I think that's another biotoxin issue with the bacteria and things in the mouth getting in and affecting the heart, affecting especially the coronary artery plaques. I think we'll find that also has a biofilm etiology.
Those
but anyway, yeah, it does. We do not have a Noetic Science meeting in December, but we'll have one in January, the third Thursday, at the Dunwoody office. It's we're bringing back our handwriting analysis expert who will give you a quick course on how to analyze handwriting, which is actually very useful, especially if you're interviewing people. So we'll have that in January. Well, Edward, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been very enlightening, and I'm going to recommend your site and your book to my patients because I think this is a great idea.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, and I really appreciate the opportunity to reach a new audience.
Great.
And I have another book you might be interested in called Transcendental Physics.
Oh, right. Yeah, we would be. We would be very interested in that. I've interviewed, I don't know, probably 30 physicists, including Dr. Goswami, on multiple occasions on consciousness.
Oh, yeah, I know Amit.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah. Well, I'll have my people get that book, and we'll get you back on the air with that one.
Oh, that'd be great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All righty. Well, take care. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and you've been listening to Temple of Health Radio Show. And join us next week.
Headaches, back pain, migraines, joint pain, nothing worse than the nagging, unending discomfort of daily aches and pains. If you have pain and are looking for more natural solutions to eliminate your pain, Millennium Healthcare is for you. Millennium Healthcare's professionals will work for you. For help or more information on natural pain relief, call Millennium Healthcare at 770-390-0012. That's 770-390-0012. Millennium Healthcare. Pain relief naturally.
So you had plastic surgery. What was it like?
It was great. Don't get me wrong. It was surgery, but the doctors and staff at Plastico's were terrific.
Honey, you look like $1 million. You actually went to Plastico's and had it done.
Why don't you? Plastic surgery is outpatient, and you'll only be out of work a few days. I love what Plastico's did for me, and looking my best is an investment that pays in so many ways. The help you get from the professionals at Plastico's is a bargain.
Plastico's, 770-457-4677. Mention this ad for a free consultation. Financing is available, 770-457-4677.
Hi, friends. It's time again. Talk about being in the no time. It was just yesterday I had that intense interview with Mr. Bajago on, Andrew Bajago, going all over the Matrix and beyond. And today is going to be more of the same with really just, an X-File lady in the flesh. You know her. If you haven't heard about her, you will now. Her name is Linda Moulton Howe. I hope I pronounced it right. She is, how do I find these people? And, they're out there. They are people who are putting themselves out in front to bring the truth through, like I'm trying to do as well. And it's really nice when there are female voices out there in the front line. And here she is, one of the spirit warriors out there that brings you truth as she understands it. And as I do, too. Her name, again, Linda Moulton Howe. Her website is earthfile.com, I think. We'll get it precise when I talk to her. She's a renowned journalist, as I said, a real warrior for truth. Linda, tell us about you. Are you with us?
Yes, I am, and it is Linda Moulton Howe. It's English for my father's family.
Sorry about that.
It's English. And the website is www.earthfiles.com, and the way to remember it is I am a longtime television radio writer and reporter, and so Earth Files is about a reporter who files news about the Earth, and my beat has always been science, environment, and medicine, And that's the way that I came after graduating from Stanford University with a master's degree in communication and having worked with the medical center there and the Stanford Linear Accelerator on my master's film, that everything I have done in television was in the context of science, environment, and medicine. And that's why in the fall of 1979, 30 years ago, that I wanted to get to the bottom of all of the unusual bloodless deaths of animals, not only in Colorado, where I was director of special projects at the CBS station there, but as I began to do research, I realized that the unusual animal phenomena was reported literally all over the world in both hemispheres, had been for nearly a century, that the modern marking day of the so-called animal mutilation phenomena, named animal mutilations by law enforcement, not reporters, and that it had made worldwide headlines that would have been including headlines in Rome, in Italy, in Europe, and around the world, was the famous September 1967 death of a horse in southern Colorado. And it ended up in my work as an investigative reporter and TV producer, writer, director, editor, that I met the medical doctor in Denver who had gone down to that initial, we'll call it the horse mutilation in southern Colorado, and I got to work with him. And in the process of working with Dr. John Altshuler, who unfortunately died about 10 years ago, we were able to, for the very first time, we were the first team that was able to report the confirmation of high heat at the excision lines, cooked hemoglobin, cooked collagen in these animals, and to demonstrate with photomicrographs the difference between normal tissue and the tissue in mutilated animals. And further, Dr. Altshuler was so puzzled when we began looking first at the tissue under a microscope, because if the heat that had cooked the hemoglobin and the collagen had been an instrument such as a laser, there should have been carbon residue. This is a carbon life form planet. If you apply a laser to any life form that has carbon in it, whether it is a human in surgery, whether it is a horse, a cow, a rabbit, a dog, it doesn't matter. Under a microscope where the laser has done its excision, which is always bloodless, you will find carbon residue that under a microscope looks like grains of black pepper. In none of the animal mutilation excisions did we ever find carbon residue. It was immediately clear and separated out animal mutilations from normal laser surgery right from the beginning. And I think that I have been out on at least 30 different cases myself where I have gone into pastures carrying formalin in plastic containers and bags to gather soil so that whenever I went out on an animal mutilation site, I was gathering soil and grass samples for a biophysicist in Michigan named W.C. Levengood, and I was collecting the tissue from the animals to go into formalin to be shipped by Federal Express to John Altshuler in Denver. So my work was going to two reputable scientists, and in my first book, An Alien Harvest, was the first publication of this hard evidence of these true anomalies in the animal mutilations that separated them from anything that military, paramilitary, or anything like that could do. And further, from the very first law enforcement sheriffs that I went to interview, both sitting sheriffs and sheriffs who had retired but had been involved in mutilations during the 1970s when it was really a widespread phenomenon around the world. It is today, but not at the extent. Something happened between 1967 and 1976 to 79, maybe 1980. There was a decade in which there were literally thousands of cases in both hemispheres occurring on this planet for reasons unknown, but one of the sheriffs that I talked to right from the get-go was Tex Graves. And Tex had just retired in Sterling, Colorado, had been sheriff there for 25 years. And in the early 70s, he told me, Linda, we were getting phone calls as many as 3 a day. They were going to animals that were warm to touch. And here the animals would be lying in front of Sheriff Tex Graves 3 a day with an ear missing, an eye missing, the jaw flesh missing, the tongue removed deep in the throat, the genitals removed, male or female.
Now, I even heard of a case where the heart was taken out without any surgery, with even the heart sac intact.
You're talking to the first journalist who reported that. And that was based on the work that I did for that documentary, A Strange Harvest, that was first broadcast on the CBS station, A Strange Harvest, and then it's been broadcast all over the United States. And in the work I did with Sheriff Tex Graves, he was the sheriff who told me that he contacted a veterinarian out of Sterling, Colorado, had him come out into the field on a on Tex Graves, the sheriff's first mutilation, back around 1970 to 71. And the veterinarian did a necropsy in the field. I've attended these also, and they take about 4 hours to do, and they carefully take apart an animal the way a mechanic would take apart a car engine. And they methodically are looking for bruise, for hemorrhage, for any signs of anomaly. And when they opened up that first animal mutilation that Tex Graves investigated, they found that the pericardium, the clear translucent sac that surrounds the heart of all creatures, including humans, or mammals, including humans, the pericardium was lying inside of the chest of this mutilated cow. It had not one drop of blood in it or on it. There was a 1 teaspoon measured of a clear, pale pink liquid inside of that pericardium. And when the veterinarian and the sheriff discussed how this could have been accomplished, since there was no excision of any kind into the chest of that animal, the veterinarian told Sheriff Tex Graves, don't ever call me out on another one of these cases. I am not going to stand in front of microphones and tell the media that I am looking at something that is impossible to do, because I'm not going to say that, but what we have here is impossible to do.
Oh.
And it was Sheriff Tex Graves who was the very first law enforcement person in September of 1979 to tell me point blank, but not on camera. This was off camera. And I'm a TV producer, so I need people to tell me on camera, but I'm telling you what he told me in the beginning off camera. Linda, we're not dealing with predators, disease, or satanic cults. We are dealing with something from outer space. And it took 2 months until October of 1979 for the crew and I, and we were traveling between Wyoming, Colorado, and New Mexico interviewing everyone who had had mutilations, interviewing law enforcement, even interviewing fellow journalists. And it was down in Trinidad, Colorado, in a 10 o'clock interview, the only time that we could get with the chief investigator of animal mutilations for the district attorney's office in Trinidad. His name was Lou Giroto. He later became sheriff of that county. And that night, with my TV camera running, he said to me on camera in answer to my question that I was asking everyone that we interviewed, who or what do you think is killing and mutilating these animals? And Lou Giroto, without flinching, looks at me and the camera and says, well, other investigators and I have come to the conclusion that we are dealing with creatures from outer space. So finally, a person in a highly credible position in law enforcement told me what other people in law enforcement were telling me only off the record. And that was the beginning of the very first breakthrough in my documentary that earned an Emmy Award that I had somebody who was willing from a credible position to say, we're dealing with creatures from outer space. Well, that was step
number one. Let me just interrupt you a moment, Linda. So then are you saying that you are, it sounds like, the first journalist to bring the story out?
I was.
Wow. Kudos to you.
Well, that's what the television program, I'm surprised that you're not aware, A Strange Harvest, was first broadcast in May of 1980. We're talking on December 7th, 2009. In that broadcast 30 years ago, there were law enforcement, there were ranchers, there were scientists who were describing in the film the physical evidence that separates the bloodless, strange animal mutilations from predator disease and satanic cults. And I'm the reporter and the TV producer. They are the ones who are reporting directly on camera about their own investigations and their conclusions, of which Lou Girodo was the first to say, we're dealing with creatures from outer space. And that's why when A Strange Harvest was broadcast in a two-hour special on May 25th, 1980, for the first time, it was like a bomb went off in my life and in the CBS station's life, because mail started coming in huge bags. I was getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of mail. Remember, there was no email then. This was hard mail written on typewriters and by hand that were sent to me in letters that came to me at the station in bags, hundreds and hundreds, saying, I have also had animal mutilations, or I've never told anyone this before, but I saw a helicopter change into a cloud over my pasture. There was a lot of that. People who had seen what appeared to be helicopters that made no sound over their ranches, and then they would see the helicopters transform into clouds. There were sheriffs who saw that, deputies who saw that, ranchers who saw that. And when they saw those helicopters that changed into clouds, or when they saw what they called the lights that looked like orange fire, they knew that there were going to be mutilations. And there was one deputy sheriff in Elizabeth, Colorado, who in the 1970s, I did the interview with him in, I believe it was December of 1979, and they had been dealing with literally hundreds and hundreds. I saw all of their case files in Elizabeth, Colorado, in that county. And he said that one night they got a call that there was something unusual in the sky, and he and another deputy took out to a ranch area where they had been having multiple animal mutilations, the same bloodless kind that I've described, that John Altshuler and I and the biophysicist have studied. And he said they were driving down a road in a very rural part of that ranching community, and they saw an orange fiery light in the distance coming at rapid speed toward their car. And both men, being experienced law enforcement men, hit their door opener, the handles, and they slammed on the brake. The driver, Deputy Waugh, slammed on the brake, so the car was rolling sort of to a stop when both deputies rolled out, and on the ground, lying on his back, Deputy Waugh said that he watched this fiery orange light that he estimated was approximately 3 to 4 feet in diameter come right to the front windshield of the car that was still rolling on the road and do a 90-degree angle turn right at the window. When the deputies got up off the ground to retrieve their car, they were further astonished by seeing a red rectangle of light in trees nearby, and that scared them so much that they drove immediately back to the sheriff's office and said, we'll go back and investigate after the sun comes up. The next morning, they go back to the intersection where the orange light nearly collided with their car and where they both saw a red glowing square of light in the trees. There at the intersection, which was dirt, these are rural roads, there's no asphalt, this was dirt, there was the marks of their car screeching to a rolling stop in the dirt. There were the prints of both of them rolling off onto the road out of the car. And there where they saw the red square of light in the trees, they were looking at flat grass, no trees. And he said, Linda, at that point, he and I looked at each other and said, what the is going on? We saw trees here last night. We saw a red square of light. What is going on? And I have heard that description of what I consider to be some kind of camouflage that the phenomena is able to project into human lives, so that at one time we think we're looking at trees and there are no trees. There was a
either that or it's a lost time phenomenon.
Well, I think we're dealing with holographic projections, and I'll tell you why. There was a physicist working at Los Alamos, and he worked at Sandia Labs, and he contacted me about this, would not talk on the record. He said, you need to know that we're dealing with phenomena that apparently can project images that the humans cannot tell from anything around us. We can't tell what is real and what is not real when it comes to this phenomena's ability to project. And he said that he personally was driving on a road in Colorado. This would have been approximately 1975 to 76 when there was the highest spike of animal mutilations and UFOs ever reported in the United States. And he was on a road, there's a freeway that goes up to northern Colorado, and for a part of it, it is paralleled by a railroad track. On the railroad track, he was very puzzled to see what he thought were two boxcars back-to-back, just stationary on the railroad track. And he became so concerned that a train, which is very frequent there, would come through and then would crash into these railroad boxes, that he was contemplating where he would stop to call some authorities. Remember, there were no cell phones there then either. It was not an electronic age. It was mail and it was phones. So as he is worried about what is going to happen, the two boxcars suddenly rose straight up into the air and disappeared. He said, Linda, there's no other explanation to my mind as a physicist, except that I was not looking at three-dimensional boxcars that were heavy. I had to have been looking at a projection that was so perfect that my mind perceived them as boxcars.
Now, was this in any way associated with also with a sighting of a mutilation?
Oh, mutilations were happening in the hundreds every day then.
No, I mean this particular event with the boxcars.
No, he wasn't seeing animals. But it was in the context of so many, many reports. I had so many people tell me about the helicopters that were silent that changed into clouds, or in one particularly dramatic case, there was a woman in a ranch where there had been mutilations, and one night her dogs woke her up barking and going screaming and clawing at the walls. And she got up and walked to the door out onto a deck. Now she's on the second story. She said, Linda, my God, the starry sky was as clear as can be. There wasn't a cloud, but there was this roaring sound of a helicopter, and I could feel downdraft, but Linda, I could see nothing. I've heard that many times.
But see helicopters and hear nothing, and there are others who hear helicopters and see nothing.
That's right.
That's pretty bizarre, isn't it? It's kind of like just some sort of a warp.
No, we're coming back to what the physicist said. If you are a sophisticated intelligence that can come here for whatever are the agendas, which we haven't even discussed, then the ability to project holograms that humans cannot tell from the world around them, that would be part of what the physicist was describing. He feels that we're dealing with a phenomena that uses holographic projections all the time. It just depends upon the human environment and what humans are looking, and would see boxcars rise, oil drums rise, see trees that are really not there, and then they report it. Otherwise, we do not know that we have holograms interacting with the planet.
Right. Another phenomenon, another aspect of the phenomenon that's very interesting is the many cases where the animals have been appear to have been dropped out of a craft, or literally dropped out of the sky. Or I recall one event where they were piled up. I think there were about 12 cows piled up in a grain silo.
2 years ago, I was flown by a TV production company in Canada up to a site in Montana. And this is where a sheriff had called me and said, Linda, we have a case. We want your help. And a TV production crew at the time had also simultaneously contacted and said, if you get any fresh mutilations, please let us know. So we documented this, and this has been broadcast on Canadian television, and here is the short version. The sheriff called because he said, we're looking at a site where it's very clear to us that the animal was dropped from above, made a crater in the ground, and literally bounced and fell in the position where we have found it, but the animal is mutilated. So I'm there, and I'm collecting grass and soil, and collecting tissue and giving them my feedback on this animal, which was in many ways the classic mutilation with some variations, and was especially intrigued by the crater and then realizing that the position where the animal is very odd, because all of the stubble, the wheat stubble, this was a wheat field that had been harvested earlier where the animal had been dropped, all of the wheat stubble that was about 3 inches long was laying down under the animal going exactly the opposite direction from a bounce. If the wheat had been going in the direction of the bounce, we would never have noticed anything. It was all laying completely 180 degrees opposite, and it was so puzzling to me that I collected soil and plants from both the bounce mark and from this wheat stubble and the soil underneath the animal. And it turns out that biophysicist Levengood in Michigan was able to use what is a well-established soil pressure impact logarithm and was able to determine even and estimate the size of an object that would have, the mass that would have had to have impacted in the crater. And then when it came to what could possibly explain how the wheat stubble could be going exactly the opposite direction of the inertial physical vector of the motion of the cow, he found that without question, there had been an electromagnetic interaction with that soil that produced magnetite in a large concentration in that soil that normally would not be found and was not in any of the controls. And that fits into work that we have done in many things, from crop formations to animal mutilations to human abductions, in which there is this beam, the beam that has been described by many people. This beam technology seems to be what is interacting and putting these animals, taking them up and putting them down. And that beam interaction has magnetic field effects on organic matter and soil. And his conclusion was that magnetic field from this beam technology, which we do not understand, we just know it is there by witness observation, affected the wheat stubble so that it was actually pulled down to the ground in the opposite direction of the moving cow.
That is remarkable, and it so speaks of the crop circle.
Well, and I have reported this in great depth with photographs and scientific analysis at Earth Files. And it's one of the goals of having done Earth Files for 10 years now. It's starting to go into its 11th year. And I wanted from the very beginning that the very first report that I did in 1999 at Earth Files, that the reports would accumulate chronologically in order. There are now almost 2,000 reports with 40,000 images and documents at Earth Files. In order to do this, I have to have a subscription charge for access to these extensive 10 years of archives and to the real X-Files. And for people who are interested, I think it is an amazing value because you can go back. You can type into the search mode Montana or animal mutilations or whatever information that you have. And in this case, this was in Montana, I think it was 2 years ago in 2007, And you will come up, if you have the subscription access, to the entire reports that were done with the scientific reports that we were able to contribute. And
Let me just ask you, Linda, what is the subscription charge for this?
$40 a year.
All right, listen, people,
so that's
you know, it's
$3
of good value. It's also about supporting people who are out there dedicating their lives. So please consider, don't go now because you don't want to miss a minute of Linda, but after we finish the show, you want to check out earthfiles.com and see what you can do to give her some support by getting a subscription and giving yourself a key to all of these years of incredible and often, I'm sure, risky journalism and information gathering.
Yes, and thank you. And if any of your listeners become subscribers, know that you can go to and type in the search engine is very good. All you have to do is type in keywords such as 2007 Montana or animal mutilations, and you will get all of this information I'm talking about now about this extraordinary case in which we found soil anomalies and which we found plant anomalies in a mutilation in Montana.
Fantastic. And just for anybody that's tuned in on the half hour, we are talking with Linda Moulton Howe. I got the pronunciation right this time. We're talking about animal mutilations, and we're just scratching the surface here. We haven't even started talking about the why of it. We're just talking about Linda's experience and endless knowledge of what she's seeing, when, why, how. We haven't gotten to why yet, but we'll be doing that in the next half hour. Linda, are you well aware of the recent calf mutilations found in Colorado?
Yes, and they don't fall into any category that I have ever seen myself in 30 years and know from studying the history of animal mutilations going back to the beginning of the 20th century. They don't fall into anything in the 20th century at all. Now, what did happen in that it's back to the Alamosa, San Luis, Crestone area of the horse I talked about before that was found in September of 1967, stripped of flesh from the neck up, no blood, that John Altshuler had visited and found that all of the chest organs, including heart, lungs, liver, all the major organs had been removed from that horse in September of 67. But there was no blood. There were very odd tripod tracks 100 feet from the body of that animal. And that was the first case that went worldwide with headlines saying, did something from outer space kill this horse near Alamosa? The most recent ones that you're referencing from November are cases also in that same area, the San Luis Valley, Alamosa, Crestone, Mount Blanca, that has been a repeated area of animal mutilations for at least 50, 60 years. And in this current November 2009, four calves on one ranch, all as if somebody had taken a can opener to the hide and kind of rolled the hide up, exposing very deep red tissue. All of the hemoglobin is there, and the ribs are exposed. This is not the classic animal mutilation of bloodless and very precise removal of an ear, an eye, jaw flesh, tongue, genitals, and rectum cordat. And the unprecedented nature of these four calves stops me in my tracks of really knowing exactly what to do, except that I am thinking about doing a report that would select some of the classic mutilations covering 20 or 30 or 40 years and putting them in a page in chronological order leading up to photographs of the four calves now in October of 79 so that people can see the huge contrast and would understand that I am as baffled as anybody about what happened to those four calves in November.
Well, there are so many hypotheses. One could be that there's a different kinds of tests are being performed. And another could be that it's a different a group of aliens that are investigating different things.
But how would we
more earthly explanations.
Right.
Which, of course, I just want to bring up that, you know, every third report you hear about cattle mutilations, you hear the standard story about scavengers coming to the animal, and this is even scientists saying that it's not unusual for them to attack the anal cavity, blah, blah, blah. And then you look at these kinds of examples, and it should dawn on people that, first of all, no scavenger animal rips the skin back on a big mammal. But what is not seems to be reaching home is that it appears that no scavenger animals other than vermin want to even get near these cadavers.
No, well, no. In the animal mutilations, one of the hallmarks, one of the characteristics that has been reported since the middle of the 20th century, wolves, coyotes, bears, large cats will not touch the mutilated animals. I had a personal experience of this in 1994. I remember very clearly being in Las Vegas, New Mexico, not Nevada. There's Las Vegas, New Mexico here, where there had been a series of animal mutilations and lots of highly strange lights reported by residents there. And I spent a week doing investigations. And I was trying to remember, there were so many in Las Vegas, Mora, but this was one day where I drove up to a place called Angel Fire. These are all quite close to each other. They're just different geographic names. And at Angel Fire, it was a rancher that over a period of 12 months had had over a dozen mutilated animals, and here was one while I was there. And as we walked from pulling up his truck as close as we could, and still we had a whole quarter to a half a mile to walk. This is how rough and rural these pastures are. We couldn't even drive out there. And we are walking, and we could see a coyote pacing back and forth, back and forth. And as we got closer, the coyote stayed approximately 10 to 12 feet from this newly mutilated cow, walking back and forth as if there was an invisible glass wall. And it wasn't until the rancher and I got to maybe within 50 feet and clearly watching this coyote pace the whole time we walked, when we got within 50 feet, the coyote finally decided that it had to run away. Well, the rancher and I stood there remarking and how remarkable it was that these hungry coyotes, and he had seen this before, they would come up to the animals, but no more than 10 to 12 feet and would never touch the mutilated carcass. I saw that with my own eyes.
This reminds me of an event in the crop circles where a horse got up to the outer edge of the formation, but it wouldn't go near it. It started acting very weird, barking.
Oh, people noticed back in 1989 to 1990, at the beginning of the modern age of crop formations, this was another one of the first things that was reported, in addition to all the videotapes of the mysterious lights that were hovering over crop formations. There were a lot of videotapes then. People would say, I was going along the tram line to get into the formation, and my dog was with me. I get to the formation, my dog is behind me, I walk into the formation, and the dog starts yelping and whining and will not cross the edge of the formation. There have been hundreds of reports like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about one of the questions I have for you is, aside from the science, did you have any sense of, or any psychic or emotional or sensory feeling as you approached that animal of that was something signaling something otherworldly? You can call it creepiness or crawling skin, or what kind of physical sense did you have when you were out there?
The very first animal that my television crew and I approached was, I believe I even remember the date, it's so indelible, I think it was October 6, 1979. And it was the very first animal that I was to see firsthand. And we went with Walsenburg, I believe, Colorado. And we were with two deputies. And they were leading us, and the crew and I were completely blank. We had no idea, except that, of course, we'd seen photos, but we had no idea what we were headed toward. We're following the deputies. And the deputies had told me, which is why I went there with the crew, that this was the most extraordinary animal mutilation that they had investigated up to that point, and I'm going to tell you why. We see the deputies in front of us. My cameraman has a big camera on his shoulder. This was the day of 16-millimeter film. My audio guy is connected in an umbilical cord to a Nagra. This is what was called double system 16-millimeter film 30 years ago, not digital small cameras today. This is big equipment. And they are on umbilical cords, and we are following the two deputies. And we see the deputies in front of us pushing very hard through willows. And my cameraman says, God, Linda, I don't know if we're going to be able to get through there. And the reason is they've got this equipment that's umbilical. So we did a motion, take the equipment to the air, meaning that the guys are going to have to lift their equipment over their heads as far as they can, and we'll do our best to see if we can follow the deputies pushing through the thickest willows. I'm talking about trying to push through a mat. It was that thick.
Boy.
And we successfully pushed through these willows with the gear up above the crew's head, and we now are on a little grassy ledge. The little grassy ledge with a thick willow to our back is facing thick trees. Their branches are down so thick in front that they are coming to the ground in front of us. And the deputies are holding open the tree branches for us to walk through. And now the crew and I are having to bend over. In fact, we got on our knees to get into or through the branches that the deputies are holding open. And now we are in sort of what you might call a protected umbrella space created by the trees that we could now stand up, if you understand what I mean. If you're in trees that are tall enough to have branches that come down to the ground, but once you get through those branches, you can stand up in the space between the ground and where the branches come from the tree. Now that's what we're in. And here is this steer. And the steer looks so perfect that it looks like it should get up. This is not decaying. There are no maggots. This is fresh. But where the left ear should have been is a perfect circle, like you would draw with a compass. And it is approximately 3 inches wide on the left side of the face. The animal was lying on its right side. This is the left ear. The left eye is perfectly removed along with the eyelids, with a perfect circle of hide removed in there, just like the ear. Now there's another 3-inch perfect circle of hide removed around the eye with everything clean there. The left jaw is perfectly removed in one half down to the bone. There is, there's no flesh on the bone whatsoever. Where the penis should have been was a perfect oval. It was as if you took an oval cookie cutter that was 6 inches long and 3 inches wide, forming an oval, and you had pressed it through only the hide, and you removed the penis, and here now is the lumen tissue. The lumen is the pale tissue that covers muscle. The lumen tissue is still there, and in the rectum, the rectal area had been completely and totally cored out perfectly in about a 6-inch hole that went approximately 12 inches into the body of this steer. And I am feeling, for the very first moment, as a human being, as a reporter, as a TV producer, that I'm in the presence of something that my left brain that I have depended upon for my entire life cannot explain. And it is in those moments of the perfection It is the perfection, the preciseness of the animal that you are first stunned, and then what immediately kicks in. How in the world did this large animal end up under these thick tree limbs above us without one sign of breakage? How would the animal have gotten through the thick willows that we had to push and raise camera gear and no sign of broken tree limbs when we had to get down on our knees to get in there? How in the world did this perfectly mutilated steer get in the place that it is in? And that is exactly what the deputies wanted us to see. And when I said, how in the world, we're now running camera to these deputies, and we are doing the interview inside of this space, how in the world could the animal have even gotten here? And this is where the two deputies said, Linda, this was the very first thing that hit us. In addition to the lack of blood, no tracks, no broken branches, anything. How did this huge steer, and it was big, get here? Now that is the beginning of square one for me. And then you couple that with 30 years of interviews that I have done with ranchers and law enforcement and fellow journalists and scientists. And you have, I have personally at least a dozen firsthand reports from people who have talked to me about seeing the beams come into pastures, seeing animals rise in these beams up to something that they don't know what it is in the sky. And in some cases, they have seen animals lowered back down in these beams or dropped from beams. It's possible that this beam technology has the ability to take the molecule and matter of a huge, dense steer and literally, in order to shock and stun human minds, put it into this tiny, strange space, almost like a joke. You don't have a clue who we are, what we are, where we come from, what we are doing, and this is the way we demonstrate. That's the way we all felt when we left there.
That's not a very positive feeling.
No, it is what made me mistrust the phenomena right from the very beginning of my very first days in production in A Strange Harvest. And today, 30 years later, I have walked a million miles in phenomena trying to understand. And I feel no more trust today than I did 30 years ago. But I'll tell you this, if it's any comfort to your audience. I don't know of a single case of any rancher in his family anywhere being personally hurt in any physically violent way by the phenomena with animal mutilations occurring right around their house trailers or their ranches or out in a pasture where they have been standing when a beam of light has come down over an animal. The humans seem to be left alone as if part of the signal in this strange communication is, we're not here to do anything to you, but we need something from these animals.
And I would like to interject here, and I always mention this when I'm out in public speaking, that we have to remember that as appalling as that might appear to us, we have to remember that this is we're doing these kinds of experiments on animals ourselves.
Well, we eat animals.
I mean, we're not drawing animals off the field, but... Were you an alien species watching the human race cutting into animals, live vivisection, and experimenting on them? They may very well think that this is okay with us.
Francois, around the earth, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, how many animals, especially in the cattle, are being butchered for humans to eat?
Exactly.
There's millions.
Or to make lipstick, or to create new vaccines.
Well,
and so, you know, it's important.
The point I was trying to make is, if you are an outside intelligence and you're looking at a planet and you need genetic material for something that is your need, and you look at the planet, each planet that you visit, and you try to find where the life form intelligence on that planet, what does it use, what does it not use, what does it eat, what does it not eat? If you said that whatever we're dealing with selected for most of the mutilations, the one animal that is eaten on this planet in both hemispheres.
That's true. But I do also, when you were talking about it being some kind of an alien joke, I just wanted to remind people that this is what we do in laboratories, too.
No. I'm sorry. Maybe it's a language thing. The idea...
No, I'm understanding what you're saying about them.
The joke has to do with how that animal was placed, almost as if we're dealing with an intelligence that understands that it is constantly surprising, shocking, stunning, and baffling humans, and takes almost a kind of joking delight in doing some of the placements of animals under tree roots, hanging them in trees. There's a huge variety, as if to astonish us.
So what do you think is the reason for this, or even for this aspect, to astonish us? For what purpose? To what end?
Well, if you go to what seems to be at least a consensus of what could be the agenda, there is only one that I feel that I could give out publicly even today that might even come close, and that is a genetic harvest. Once you say that the animal mutilations are providing a genetic harvest for one or more non-human intelligences interacting with the Earth, the big question is, genetic harvest to make what? To do what? There isn't anyone that I've ever talked to in military intelligence, government, civilian intelligence, and I've talked with many off the record. They don't know the reason either, but they will agree that it appears that we're dealing with non-humans who are harvesting genetic material from the Earth, and it goes further than that. I've talked with a couple of men with very long careers, having to do with the geopolitical interests of extraterrestrial biological entities in this planet, is the way they describe it. And their point of view is that genetic harvests from this planet have been going on for more than a quarter of a billion years by the same intelligences that are interacting with the Earth now. Once you hear a statement like that, and you say to people who can give you some a little proof that they in fact did work for the United States government in areas having to do with the research and study and monitoring of extraterrestrial biological entities, and you say, how in the world would any human under any circumstances in any agency trust information from something that is non-human that comes and abducts humans and mutilates animals and may heal some people sometimes, but that will not allow or will not give the human community a chance for straightforward communication about who we are, what we are, why we're here, why we're mutilating animals, why we are doing genetic harvests, and all of that. And the answer that was given to me is one that I always remember. Linda, we have been able to retrieve technologies from some of their craft that appear to have even been given to us as a gift, that seem to record the history of this planet as if our solar system has been interacted with and monitored for more than a quarter of a billion years. Well, it doesn't answer my question of how would humans have proof, because why I'm asking that is, it is a question that has bothered me for 30 years. I've come to the conclusion that Homo sapien, the current model of the hominid on the Earth that we call human, Homo sapien, is very akin to bacteria on a petri dish on a microscope. The eyes looking down onto that petri dish are not human. They are something else. And that the bacteria, the human bacteria on the petri dish, have no way of getting an objective view of the petri dish, the microscope, and the eyes looking down.
Right.
We may be in that position going forward into the future forever, that we will never be able to have an objective view of the eyes looking down on us. But it seems to me that the other piece that has been suggested to me over the 30 years by people who have worked in military and government is that we are dealing with at least three main non-human intelligences who do not get along. They have three completely different agendas. And that within those multiple agendas, one of them relates to extraterrestrial biological entities manipulating DNA in already evolving primates to create Homo sapiens. That's a direct quote from a document that I was shown at Kirtland Air Force Base in 1980 when I was working, April 9th, 1983, when I was working on an hour documentary to produce for Home Box Office here in the United States. And in the process of being shown that document, allegedly prepared for a president of the United States, not specified in the title page, but just a briefing paper for the president of the United States of America on the subject of unidentified aerial vehicles, and the acronym was UAVs, not UFOs, and it went into a long list of the retrievals of non-human technologies, unidentified aerial vehicles, from a variety of places in the United States, including two different episodes in the Roswell, New Mexico area, one in July of 1947, from which we were studying three, and they were not round, they were not lens-shaped, they were shaped like pie wedges, and another similar experience that occurred in 1949, about which no one has ever received hard data, but it was on this list, among many other places. And in this, it was approximately a 8 or 10 page document typed. It went into paragraphs that I've never forgotten, almost like a photographic memory. And one of those paragraphs, after listing the retrieval of these various, what they were referred to in the paper as extraterrestrial, what would be craft, and the back engineering are giving to our scientists the challenge of trying to back engineer some of the technology they found, there was this paragraph. And it said very specifically, and I've never forgotten it, and I wrote it down in a notebook after, and I've reported that in my own, I've done four books. My first book, An Alien Harvest, came out in 1989 with a lot of physical evidence reported about much of this, followed by two books that it took me 8 years to produce, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1, Facts and Eyewitnesses, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 2, High Strangeness, much having to do with my interviews off the record with government sources, some of which died, and I have reported what I could in those two books. And the four.
Okay, Linda, I'm going to have to cut you off soon because we're just about the end of our time.
Right.
So what
the whole thing about this is I'm saying that in those books, what I'm talking about, I have reported in An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and Volume 2. So if you want to read further about the document that I was shown for allegedly for an American president in 1983, you can read quite a bit in those three books.
Okay, and what was it that you said you would never forget, the quote that you would never forget?
That.
You've forgotten.
I think that it related to the idea that we had technology. I think I said that. We had technology we had retrieved from the craft that proved to them that we were dealing with intelligences
that
go back before the
time
of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Well, so that was what I've never forgotten, was that we had that they were telling me that we had retrieved technology that had proved to them that we were dealing with intelligences that we're more than 270 million years of involvement with this planet.
Well, there you go. That's a long, long time for us to wait as civilizations, although we know that many civilizations have demonstrated and recorded, even in the glyphs and in the walls of ancient walls, encounters with beings from other worlds. We've got to end the show tonight with Linda. Thank you, Linda. It has been so revealing and exciting hearing what you've got to tell us, and I'm sure if you'll come back, we can delve in even deeper. You've been listening to Linda Moulton Howe. Her website is earthfiles.com. Please go there, check her out, see if you can get into that subscription file so that by donating to her, you let her keep doing her work and you get your hands on all the detail that she's just been able to scratch on in this brief encounter tonight and today on Your Side of the World. Thank you, Linda, so much.
Oh, and thank you.
And thank you for your great work. And I hope we'll touch base again soon. Hey, everybody, I'm off to Amsterdam where I'm doing some workshops and talking about more things beyond the Matrix. So I'll be back with you next week, and we'll have another mind-blowing section. Not a section, a session. Beyond the Matrix in the free thought zone. Goodbye, everybody. Be good. Tune in. Wake up. Pay attention. This is Patricia Corey saying arrivederci.